Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Amy Villarejo. At Cornell University, Villarejo is an associate professor of film in the Department of Theater, Film, and Dance, as well as director of the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies program. She speaks and writes extensively on the subjects of queer popular film, television, and video. She's also the author of an award-winning book, Lesbian Rule, Cultural Criticism and the Value of Desire, published by Duke University Press. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thanks for having me, Tish. It's a treat.
I want to start with what was it that sparked such a deep interest in film in you, in such a way that you write critiques about it and books about it? Tell us.
I think it was that I was starved for it. Maybe I was an English major in college in a very traditional curriculum at Bryn Mawr, where we encountered not a single film, I think, in most of the curriculum. And my senior year, we had a visiting Mellon Fellow who came to teach and taught a course on television and a course on film. And I was absolutely hooked, not only by film as a medium, but by what was then an incredibly vibrant sort of birth of feminist film criticism and theory, which began sort of in the early 1980s and was gaining momentum as I was a senior. So it was an incredibly exciting moment intellectually, and I was taken by it.
Mm-hmm. And prior to that, were you interested just in popular film, just as a normal person?
I mean, as normal as I get, yeah, I suppose.
We were both brought up in California, and there is a film tradition there in
That's
some ways.
That's right. No, yeah. I grew up in L.A. until I was 12, and so was in the film industry as one is, if one lives there. So saw Starsky and Hutch being taped at my elementary school, and was, you know, frequently running into crews and whatnot. And of course, I went to films as a kid and as a teenager, and began to see some classic film by the time I got to college. So the first film that really caught my attention is probably the film Queen Christina, which I remember seeing in college in the biology lecture hall with those kind of cold tables.
Greta
Garbo
Greta Garbo. Oh, that touched on a lot of our nerve endings.
Absolutely.
It was incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that really, that experience of seeing cross-dressing, seeing this luminous figure of Garbo on the big screen in 16 millimeter was quite exciting, and I ended up writing about that. Was my first book.
Yes,
so that's
yes.
That is what caught me.
Uh-huh. And when did you actually begin to hone in then on gay and lesbian films in particular?
That was in graduate school. I had gone to Pittsburgh following Gayatri Spivak, who's a sort of post-colonial critic and theorist, and she very quickly left, but I stayed quite happily amongst a group of faculty who remain the finest in the country, in my view, in terms of a range of interests and a capacity to talk about film from all sorts of critical angles, but also a real care about popular culture. And they nourished that as I was also then encountering an explosion of film, gay and lesbian film, particularly in the early 1990s, a lot of film that was in response to AIDS and to activist concerns that were then gelling. And by the time 1992 rolled around, the year that Ruby Rich claimed was the inaugural moment of what she called the new queer cinema, I was smack in the midst of graduate study and working with the Pittsburgh Lesbian and Gay Film Festival and starting to become immersed in that world quite fully.
What name some film? Are there any films that you could discuss briefly that our listening audience might have heard of that was part of that early movement
of
gay and lesbian films?
And I'll bet they know lots of them. Mm-hmm. But that moment was marked probably most profoundly by the work of Todd Haynes, who most people know now. He recently made a terrific film called Far From Heaven. But his early work at around that moment followed from a terrific experimental film he made called Superstar that was a biopic about Karen Carpenter, half of the popular duet, the Carpenters, and her struggle with anorexia, which he shot using Barbie dolls and then carved away slowly the plastic on the Barbie doll in order to kind of chart her decline. And that's a very powerful film. He followed that with a much more commercial set of films, including a film called Poison, which was a trilogy involving Jean Genet and some kind of disturbing and interesting queer fantasies at that moment. Tom Kalin made a film called Swoon at about moment, about the Leopold and Loeb murder of a young boy, and sort of tried to revisit that through the lens of a queer retelling of this story that was sort of popularly circulating still fully 20 years or 60 years after the actual thing occurred. So it was in that sort of very male, very white.
Yeah, I was going to say, where do you put a film that now looks so corny to us called Personal Best? Do you remember that one?
I love that film.
That was a breakthrough film then, but, you know, soon after we all started saying, oh my goodness.
Right. Well, I think we're probably saying, oh my goodness, because it seems as bland and saccharine now as it probably was then, but the thrill of seeing marvelous athletic women involved in something like a lesbian relationship was a breakthrough at that moment and inaugurated a whole set of conversations that are ongoing about how best to gauge the representation of lesbians and gay men and how that might be turning into a different set of concerns about queer visions that are emerging now fully 30 years after many of those important early films hit the screens.
And listen, in the introduction to Lesbian Rule, you began with a question about the 1935 film Sylvia Scarlett, in which the character Sylvia, played by Katharine Hepburn, disguises herself as a boy and goes off and travels with her no-good father. And your question was, why has that image of Hepburn been thought of as a lesbian image? Talk to us about that.
That was the moment with which I began an exploration that continues now. And the question really has to do with the disjunction between these incredibly multifaceted lives that we know gay men and lesbians and queer people and trans people live. And they're anchoring on the screen, and particularly in the commercial cinema, the narrative cinema, in particular ways that become codified and become available for consumption as lesbian images. So I was interested in how the varied material of our lives, the varied ways that we look, the varied ways that we walk, the various ways that we imagine ourselves, which have nothing to do with our bodies, those become very quickly, and I would hesitate to say, but will rigidly, anchored in certain kinds of images, which we are then given to recognize as queer or as lesbian or as gay, witness the controversy over Brokeback Mountain. And so I'm particularly keen to on the one hand to want to celebrate those images and to say that they've been extremely important for self-recognition, for struggles to become legitimate, to understand oneself as a luminous, wonderful screen image, as beautiful as Katharine Hepburn, and on the other hand, to see that there's some cost politically, socially, psychically, to constraining our sense of what we recognize as a gay image on screen.
Absolutely. I was thinking about that, too, because the early images, the touchstones in which we identify lesbian, were pretty much women dressed up like men.
Absolutely.
And
they looked
certainly
fabulous.
That has evolved. They absolutely did.
Right.
And women still do look fabulous when they do that, but that's not the only image in which to talk about or even engage in a conversation about gay and lesbian lives.
Precisely. And I think that my work, you know, in an academic idiom has been trying to propose other ways of thinking about images and those names in order to open up the space for a sort of impossibly varied and unconstrained understanding of what those names might actually mean or refer to. So when I argue in Lesbian Rule that I want to understand lesbian, and this is an academic word, as a catachresis, what I'm trying to argue is that I want to leave that word permanently without a referent or permanently in chase of what it refers to, rather than anchoring it in any particular historical or social or class or raced understanding of what that term refers to, because it will multiply.
Well, it's always in flux.
Absolutely.
That's the wonderful thing about identity.
Right.
As well.
That's right.
Yeah. To tell us a little story, you wrote to Katharine Hepburn and Anne. To tell us the question you asked her and the reply she gave you in regard to this question.
Sure. I should I should thank her wherever she is right now for responding to me. I wrote to her, I should say, also because she's the most famous graduate of my undergraduate alma mater, Bryn Mawr, and I managed to hijack her address from the alumni office and got to write to her at home. So I wrote to her because I had been hanging out, I suppose, at a bar in Philadelphia, a lesbian bar after I graduated from college, called Hepburn's. And lining the walls were these huge posters that they had gotten somewhere of images, particularly from Sylvia Scarlett, in which she cross-dresses, as you said, as a man. And so I was hanging out and I was taking notes on these little pieces of paper that said Hepburn's, and her name and her image were plastered around this place in an effort, I'm sure, to sort of reclaim her as a lesbian icon. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what she would think of that, whether she ever went to Hepburn's or whether she had any idea that her name and her image were so firmly anchored to this version of lesbian self-recognition that was happening in Philadelphia in the mid-1980s. And so I wrote to her and I asked her whether she knew and what she thought of her image being circulated under this name of lesbian. And it was an incredibly long letter. It had probably, oh, I don't know, you know, 5 or 10 single-spaced paragraphs in which I sort of tried to explain.
It wasn't just a question,
it was a
story.
That's right. It was quite a long inquiry. And she wrote back 2 lines, sort of chastising me for even asking the question. But it was kind of her to send a reply with her autograph on it, which I have framed in my office.
Oh, I'll bet you do.
Yeah.
And then, so what were the 2 lines?
I will read them to you, since I would not want to get Miss Hepburn wrong.
Oh, yes.
Here they are. I'm sorry, I can't answer these questions. I'm really too busy to understand why anyone would want them answered.
I can just picture her saying that. Right. Why anybody would want them answered.
That's
absolutely
right.
Well, you know, I mean, so that probably was a touchstone on which you could just go off and
that was
reach your own conclusions.
That's absolutely right. It was giving me the license to do so in
yeah.
a kind way.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. And off I went.
You know, I want to talk to you about lesbian and gay theory versus queer theory.
Yeah.
Tell us what the difference is.
Oh, boy. That's a good question
and
a tough one.
In 3 sentences.
In 3 sentences or less. It has to do very much with the moment we were just discussing, with the aftermath of activism around HIV and AIDS, and the proposition that one could think in rigorous, critical ways about the proposition, as Eve Sedgwick put it very succinctly, the proposition that people are different, and that they're different among so many different axes, so many different vectors of being and of desiring and of fantasizing and of practice and of comportment and of gendering and of sexual life, that perhaps what had become a sort of movement that anchored itself around 2 terms, gay and lesbian, wasn't sufficient enough, it wasn't open enough, it wasn't pliant enough to talk about all of those different forms of being. And so queer became another way, as we were saying earlier, to sort of postpone giving a referent to this collection of folks and practices. So it has a sort of importantly, non-normative dimension. It struggles against the norm. It struggles against the attempt to center, to name, and to anchor particular practices as deviant or perverse or as normal and appropriately mature, for example. So it's allowed a kind of expansive investment.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Amy Villarejo. She's the Associate Professor of Film in the Department of Theater, Film, and Dance at Cornell University. Did you want to expand on what you were just talking about?
Sure.
Lesbian and gay versus queer. It seems to me it's an opening.
It is an opening.
And a freeing of a message, perhaps, that is a little bit binding.
Yes, I think so. I think at the same time, it carries risks. And the risks have to do with, to my mind, a sort of departure from a lot of thinking about gender that went under the name feminism. And a lot of folks have been suspicious, and I think rightly so, about the extent to which queer becomes another name for gay men and a way to push aside feminism as old-fashioned, or as Biddy Martin has argued this very beautifully, actually, that feminism becomes a kind of stodgy old ground against which queer is seen to be expansive and mobile and fluid and all those good things. So I'm interested in the potential of queer as a new set of possibilities, but wouldn't want to sever a lot of the lineages that made gay and lesbian meaningful and important categories, particularly for social activism and for ways of thinking that have now become importantly lodged in the academy.
And also, just taking back words like queer and lesbian and gay, it's been a long struggle, because I still hear people say that I don't want to be called a queer. That's derogatory.
That's right.
But once we take it back and call it our own again,
yes,
which we did with gay, lesbian, and so on, I think it could probably come around.
I think you're absolutely right.
As empowerment.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's an argument that Judith Butler has made really forcefully about re-signifying these words that have been sort of hurled at us with hatred, and the capacity to take those and make them into not only a set of signifiers, but a set of ambitions, a set of possibilities. Strikes me as really important. So I think we're stuck now with that LGBTQ list. Yeah. We'll just use it as unwieldy as it is
for a while. Yes, it is. Thank God we got down to the at least the initials.
Right. It's a lot easier.
I wanted to talk to you, because this is one of your disciplines as well. How has the depiction of gay and lesbian and queer people in television evolved and helped
Not much.
Our images?
I would say not much.
Really?
I mean, I've been doing some work recently on TV from the 50s that sparked by an article by an old dead German philosopher, but an important one, called Theodor Adorno, in which he's watching a program, and you don't have to excavate very deeply to realize that it's the old school teacher sitcom called Armis Brooks, which was a sort of wonderful Eve Arden vehicle and had a very, you know, very queer play around this single school teacher and the possibilities of single life for a woman. And his discussion of that series in 1954 doesn't look a whole lot different from what we might want to say about how Will and Grace functions, or how stereotypes of gay men circulate on Queer Eye, which is not to say that those are horrible shows or that there's nothing that's interesting about television and the representation of gay and lesbian and or queer people, but that it's a deeply sanitized medium.
And I would say shallow as well.
And shallow indeed, right? As much as, again, we might enjoy those. So I would say that not much has changed in terms of TV, in terms of representations. Of course, everything is changing in terms of how TV is now structured and how it functions industrially. So in order to talk about what's on TV now, I think we're going to need very quickly to play some catch-up and figure out what TV is when we have 500 channels and the capacity to time shift and record and are getting our signals digitally, and the broadcast spectrum is being devoured by private ownership, and there are very few possibilities for any real articulation of a public sphere on television. So with any sort of public voice under siege, part of our response, I think, as consumers needs to be to think more deeply about the structure rather than simply the kinds of images of ourselves that we see.
Do you hope that the lesbian and gay and queer community evolves beyond minority status so that lesbian and gay film festivals are a thing of the past and those kinds of films are just mainstream and nobody even thinks of them in those boxes?
That's a wonderful question. I want to have my cake and eat it too, because I think we've already gotten to the point where a lot of queer content is in the mainstream. If this year is any indication, right, and people are calling it the year of the queer, for the Oscars, we have a biopic about one of our cherished gay writers, Truman Capote, at the top
there
of
the list. There are
problems
with that man.
There
though.
Are indeed, and we
yes,
could talk
indeed.
About them. The problem is not Philip Seymour Hoffman, however.
No. It was Truman's personality and his sad decline.
Yes.
And his meanness in
yes.
some ways.
But
yes, he was definitely an icon. And
absolutely. And we got to have Harper Lee in that beautiful
That's
portrayal
right.
in that
yes.
film, so that was a treat.
That was.
But it's queer is all over the place. I mean, it's the year of Brokeback Capote, Breakfast on Pluto, Transamerica. There are queer sort of subtexts in The Constant Gardener and The Dying Gaul. It's all over.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the kind of work that travels in the gay and lesbian film festival circuit is different. It's allows for experimentation in genres, the documentary work that is flying around mm-hmm. is really exciting and won't find its way into the multiplex anytime soon.
As a lot of documentaries wouldn't.
That's
correct?
True. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Although some are, you know, mm-hmm. Jonathan Cowett's film Tarnation made its way at least to Fall Creek, if not to
yeah.
the multiplex. So we're seeing some of that work move into places it hadn't been really, but a lot of what remains on the gay and lesbian film festival circuit is highly experimental, deeply personal, doesn't fit the formats of commercial exhibition. It's 15 minutes or it's 5 hours,
mm-hmm.
and I think we should cherish that work and keep it alive, and foster some kind of nonprofit sphere for the circulation of media works, whatever they are. So I'm all for a multi-front creative assault.
That's great. I love that. Yes, I agree with you. Let's talk a little bit about Brokeback Mountain.
You bet.
Do you think it's a breakthrough? I mean, it's somewhat of a sad film. It's taking us back to that era when love cannot speak its name out
yes.
loud. It's the Well of Loneliness on the cowboy circuit.
Absolutely.
So
I'm with you, Tish.
I loved it, and
yes.
I thought it was a beautiful film and
I
extremely
did
too. Poetic. But there again, it's showing what homophobia does to people's lives.
That's right. And, you know, there are a couple ways to think about it. One is to think of that as a throwback, and another is to appreciate what homophobia does to people's lives and to continue to think about it. I think Daniel Mendelsohn wrote a very thoughtful review recently in the New York Review of Books about the film, in which he importantly, I think, argued that it's not a universal love story as the Roger Eberts of the world would have it.
I'm glad it's not.
And that it's a very specifically gay film, and
yeah.
it's a film particularly about the closet, as
mm-hmm.
you noticed.
Absolutely.
And that story is a story of psychic and social pain yoked together. And I think that we have to continue to explore questions of vulnerability and questions of the real effects of homophobia on queer lives now, even though those stories seem sort of like downers,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's an important film for that reason, and I too, you know, enjoyed it and wept for, you know, the last hour
yeah,
of
yeah.
it and really was
but
moved
it,
by it.
It almost explored the inner world that we haven't seen before, and I think
that's
what
right.
struck people.
I think that's true.
Yeah, it's not just a big sexual dance.
It's hardly any.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, that's
stuck,
right.
You know, it got into the psyches of these young men.
Absolutely.
And I don't think we've seen that between men before.
Not on mainstream
scale.
That's right, not in mainstream theaters.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some beautiful films about gay love, but they're not playing at the Regal Cinemas. So this is a treat for that reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're the director of the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies program at Cornell as well. Tell us what your focus is there. Is it just it streams in to what we're talking about?
It does, and it also does lots of other stuff too. It's a mouthful, I know, the new name. It's the program formerly known as Women's Studies.
Yeah.
So that inheritance that we were talking about in terms of feminist work feeding into queer is really important to what we're doing at Cornell. It's a program that brings together actively a group of faculty whose research and teaching interests are in feminist gender and sexuality studies. It acts as an umbrella for the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual Studies program. It has an active roster of speakers and visitors to Cornell throughout the year, and then it also functions as an academic unit where students can major or minor, or graduate students can minor in FGSS alongside other work that they're doing academically. So it's we teach more than 1,000 students a year. It's a big, exciting program, and I feel like I'm getting my sea legs, I guess, as director, and trying to figure out in what directions the program will now go.
Mm-hmm. I also want to talk to you about, I know you teach and so on, and so you work with young people. I had Rich Savin Williams on the show, and he talked to me about his recent book, The New Gay Teenager.
Terrific.
In which he found out that a lot of gay teenagers do not want to be called gay, and they want to fold into the mainstream, and they don't want to stand out in that way. What is your experience with the young people that you're working with? Do you have the same experience?
You know, Rich's work is controversial for that reason.
I know it
because
is.
Because a lot of people would want to argue that that their self-understandings are at some remove from what they're actually doing or interested in doing. My sense is that there's a whole spectrum of student self-nomination and self-description, and that a lot of them find the term feminist or the idea of women's organizing still immensely powerful. Many of them are drawn to LBG studies because they find that way of naming identity and a set of inquiries still immensely powerful. And there are other students who want to identify sort of anti-mainstream as genderqueer or as some sort of outside gender, outside the logic.
They don't want to be put in a box.
But they don't necessarily want to be mainstream either. And then, of course, there are those students Rich has found and has explored with such acuity in his work. So I'm not sure that I'm in the best position to name a trend, because the students who come to my courses or who come to our program are fairly confident about moving under those banners already. Mm-hmm. So it may be that there's a whole nother population out there I'm not seeing who want to keep these things in play, or who have much more conservative responses to what it is that the lesbian and gay movement has accomplished in terms of making claims for mainstream lives.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time. I just wanted to ask real quickly, you're writing a book introducing film to high school students.
I sure
Tell
am.
Us a little tiny bit about that. When can we expect it?
It would be coming probably in the next year from Routledge in London, and it's called Film Studies, The Basics, and it's been my chance to do film according to what I think and to write in a way that I hope will reach not only high school students, but most of us who are lifetime film goers, but who are interested in what film studies has to offer by way of further or deeper understanding of the medium. So it's a pleasure to be finishing up, and it'll be out soon.
That's great. We'll look forward to that. Amy Villarejo, thank you so much for being with us.
Tish, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.